You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Ten minutes after 9 on Valentine's Day. Joining me is fresh from his. Well, I don't know if he's gone yet. Have you got?
Yes, it?
You did. So let's talk. We talk about your medical case all the time. When I put on my hat as attending physician,
your stethoscope.
Yeah, when I put on my stethoscope and my white coat and give you medical advice. So this time you didn't show any signs of being towards the end of your Botox cycle. How do you explain that?
That's not true.
What?
I did have it, but it wasn't as bad.
You showed
this time
no.
It was
you
pretty
didn't.
Light.
Yeah, you like in the last couple times you've like gone into the cocoon. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like the last couple weeks. I'm just like I don't want to talk. It's like, yep.
You can hear it. You can hear it in your voice. How do you explain it? So last time or the time before when you had to go twice and you were having a migraine when you got the shots, you said you thought that screwed it up. Give us your analysis, doctor.
Well, you're the doctor. I'm the patient.
No, listen to this. That's the biggest load of shit. That's called I lured him in with a piece of bread, and then I crushed his little head.
You know, a lot of it's got to be with what we've been doing. Feels good.
You think so? That has an effect? Interesting.
Definitely. There's some correlation there. Maybe we should get a study going on with it. Or just call it as it is with our two experience hats on and say, that's what it is. Don't need a study. Studies are for pussies.
I want to read you something, right? Sir, can you send me the goals and commandments? Government computers would not let me pull down the document. I want to drop that at our battalion level force preservation council today. I would think it would help with where we are as a battalion. Keep doing post-traumatic winning. I used some of it with a chaplain who was having major personal stuff going on, and it hit with a thud. Signed, a company commander at Camp Pendleton. No, he hasn't even been through the class, right? He just listens.
Right, just reads right?
And he's counseling the chaplain.
Yeah, counseling the counselor.
Yeah, how awesome is that? Right? Mike, talk about... You feel happy.
I mean,
happy dance.
Nothing in the world makes sense, right?
Right.
Once you realize that, once you realize, and like I said, I don't know why it hit me like a ton of bricks, and everybody else I'm looking at, they're just still, drinking the Kool-Aid, was when I'm sitting next to the guy. I was always that guy that the chaplain's giving me marriage counseling. And I look at him and I'm like, hey, does anybody else look at this as kind of odd? And they're like, what do you mean? He's a Catholic priest. He's never been married. He's giving me advice on being married. No one sees this as, and I'm not knocking the priesthood.
No, they're trying. They're trying.
But if you, in order to, it's that, in my experience, when I used to hear that all the time, I'd be like, stop, corporal. And what is your experience?
What do you mean?
If you're going to say, hey, here's my resume.
Is that a trick question? It's really not.
No.
It's really not.
Yeah. Tell me, hey, you want mine? I'll give it to you because I have experience. I don't have, I'm not all, but I have, as they once said, I am a mile wide and an inch deep in all matters instead of being a mile deep and only an inch wide.
In one matter. Exactly.
Yeah, I know enough about a lot of subjects.
To at least entertain them. Talk to me. So, you would say that your interpersonal peace or your personal peace is a component of this?
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, doing the talks and everything else, had a really profound effect on my life too. So it really, and as I said, the more time we talk about it, the more we learn about ourselves, and it's good.
Yeah. I had that woman on who sent me the email last Friday. She lives in Pennsylvania. I had her on yesterday. Nancy Dunham. And I sent her a message. I said, "Hey, Nancy, come on Allmarine Radio." Now, Nancy lives with cerebral palsy. And right. She's a former hospital chaplain, and she said, "I wish I would have had this stuff when I was helping other people, but I'm a disciple, and I love this stuff." So she came on yesterday. What a cool interview to talk to her. She has no affiliation with the Marine Corps other than her uncle made her an honorary Marine 4 years ago, right. She told me. To get that email, to get the one from that company commander who's counseling, I love it, he's counseling the chaplain on post-traumatic quitting. What is this shit? Here you go, chaps. Here, take it and use it. I thought it was awesome, absolutely awesome. And like I said, hasn't even got the class yet, he just listens, so very cool stuff. Well, that's interesting. So tell everybody, for those people who don't know, this email just reminded me, "Hey, Mac, what kind of shots does a gunner get? I don't know what you're talking about."
So I get Botox for migraine headaches. And so it's 35 shots every 90 days, and it's for chronic migraines. Now, I'm not saying it doesn't cure all. It cures me. And then three of the people that live around me have done it. It fixed them too. But they're finally finding out, other than the Botox for cosmetic reasons, it also cures chronic headaches. Because of the toxin, you know, Botox is poison.
Oh, it is.
Imagine that. Yeah, it's a toxin that reduces the frequency of the number of headaches by when it ejects. They put it into certain points into there that do temporary paralysis in those muscles in your head and around that can cause or trigger migraines or the onset. And it, like I said, what they found is it's about 3 months. And it's one of those things that you don't want to do earlier, because if, let's say, I started suffering headaches and now I want to do it every 7 weeks, then it's going to get 5 weeks and then 4 weeks. And then before you know it, it's not going to work at all, because you're going to have to do it every week.
Right.
But it's an alternative. There's a lot of different ways, things out there. And like you said, I stopped, you know, the VA's thing was for me, take all these medications. And hell, I was taking more medications than an 87-year-old.
How many medications were you taking?
12 a day. And I was taking... And I'm taking them in three iterations, morning, afternoon, and evening.
Did you have one of those pill organizers?
I had to. Other than write on the bottles and then separate the bottles. No, it was just stupid. But then, I mean, when I started, then being the dumbass, because I trusted medicine to some degree. You know, doctor tells you to take this. Okay, he's a doctor. He's a medical doctor. He went to a lot of school. He went to a lot of training. And then when I started reading about some of the pills I'm taking, I'm like, I'm not an epileptic. Why am I taking epilepsy medicine?
You never know. Well, I mean, Bob and some other people that listen will tell you that epileptic seizure is a symptom, is a byproduct of traumatic brain injury.
Of traumatic brain injury. Yeah. But that, what they do is they just do a blanket statement. It doesn't work for everybody.
Right.
But what the problem with those epileptic medicines and the other stuff, it fucking made me, I had no desire to do anything or just, fucking like, yeah, you remember those days?
No, well, let me tell you, it's the zombie thing. You know what I mean? It is the zombie thing, and it's a real thing. You talk to people that live with that, and
you live in a clouded world when you're on that. You're just, everything's cloudy.
Yeah. It's no bueno, man. It is. It's no bueno. So you have great sympathy, because you know people go there and they do these things and they take these drugs. And they, you know, they, like you, Mike, I mean, they, you know, well, these doctors have, you know, they have my best interest at heart. And then they do it, and they're like, man, this is, like, horrible.
This is not a quality of life. This is not what I want.
I got to fight. And that's why, you know, all these other treatment protocols that are being developed, right? Whether you know, equine therapy or all this other stuff that's being developed, it is because veterans have said, I can't do that. I need to find some other way to deal with this thing other than being numbed, right? And going through these protocols that you're giving me. Because I can't live like that.
Right.
I can't live like that. So it's kind of interesting. I have a problem with your whole Valentine's Day thing. Every day's Valentine's Day when you live with Mike Musselman. So we don't do anything. I don't like that. I just want you to know that.
I built the barn door for her for Valentine's Day.
Oh, really? Is that where we're going with that? We're going to talk about the barn door here in a second. Here's my problem with Valentine's Day, though. It's not an egalitarian event, right? When, like, for instance, if I saw Mike today, the first thing I would say to him is like, hey, what did Henrietta get you for Valentine's Day? And I would not say that. We wouldn't even have that discussion. But with women, well, what did he get you for Valentine's Day?
Yeah.
Like, you have to prove your love. So to me, it's either an egalitarian event, which means what do we do for each other? What do we do together on this day to celebrate our love? Or we don't do anything. Because it's not fair that it's a litmus test. Well, you didn't get me anything for Valentine's Day. You don't love me. Well, what the fuck did you get me? Well, that's not important. I mean, it's not like that. It doesn't go that way. I think that's bullshit. So anyway.
Well, it's a made-up holiday for women.
Well, then that's what, look, it should be a made-up holiday for everybody who's in love, right? For lovers. Mm-hmm. And if it's celebrated like that, to me, it's a great day. If it's a litmus test that you got to pass, that's bullshit. Okay? So I figured I would get that off my chest. Now, having said that, let's move on to the door. I've got a problem with the door. Okay, I'm looking at the picture of the door, and it looks to me that the bottom edge of the door isn't vertically parallel, right?
The picture's angled.
It is. So it's not. So you have the runner on the towards the ceiling that it moves on. Yay?
Yay. Yeah.
Okay. At the bottom, is there another runner that keeps it parallel, or?
Yeah, there's another runner that it's on a track. There's another runner that's on the left side of the door frame, and there's a groove, a channel that I mortared or I routered in there that it rides in. So
okay, I officially approve the door. It can stay up because I thought it was canted a little bit, and I did not. I'm like,
the picture.
Why would he hang a canted door? Because he's not like that. Covered in a line.
It's perfectly square down to freaking 1/10 of an inch.
1/10 of an inch, really? Yeah. That's interesting. It looks good, though.
Huh?
It looks good. Rudy said Cindy would want a couple of them.
Yeah.
You might? Are you thinking about starting Gunner's?
No.
Gunner's Janky Woodshop?
No, not at all.
Oh.
So I blamed something on you last night.
It's okay. That's what I'm here for. I'm a friend.
So this morning, I went out, got a couple more organizers, and now the garage is like, I pulled everything off the shelves, and everything is now, like, everything is organized and going back into
the way it used to be.
The way I want it.
Well, it was a bit of a shit show. I'm not going to lie to you. That was not.
Yeah, I got out of hand. I'll admit.
Because Mike's a pretty organized, anal dude about his stuff. Like, things that aren't his, he doesn't care about. But if it's his, stuff is covered and aligned and organized pretty well. And he's got a lot of shit between tools, right? To all your little nitinoid stuff and your gun stuff. There's a lot of stuff in there. So, anyway.
Yeah, everything's covered and aligned now.
He sent me a picture of the door, and then, you know, so when you get a picture like that, it's incumbent upon you to look at all the things that you're not supposed to look at and then ask questions about it. First of all, the storage of hazardous material. I made a comment about that. And then the general comments about the appearance of the garage, I also had to comment on. So that's all been taken care of. I like that.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Send me some more pictures of stuff whenever I can help. So just
anytime.
I'll execute the 6-step in troop leading on your ass, and we'll make sure everything stays tight down in Granbury, Texas.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Right. No problem. No problem. You lived on base housing. I want to give you a chance to comment on yesterday's big hearings about the private companies that run base housing across the nation. The black mold that is in there, the termites that are in there, a lack of a response, them coming to your house with a black light to look at your carpet. There's no visible stain, but they put the black light and say, sorry, we're going to have to replace it. That'll be $700 to you. You can write us a check. And until you do that, you won't be allowed to check out.
Whoa. Yeah. Total beef.
So your experience, you lived in really nice base housing. I don't imagine. Did you have, because if you'd had a bad experience, I would know about it. You don't sound like you had very many.
No, I had a really good experience. I mean, because I'm a clean freak anyway. So, I mean, we shampoo the carpets, you know, on a regular basis. We do a lot of things.
You do. You mm-hmm. you go down to the supermarket and get the, or mm-hmm. you have somebody come in and do it?
I call somebody, yeah.
Yeah, that's always a better way. And as truth be told, if you use those like rental ones, they don't have strong enough suction normally to get out the most of the water that you inject into your padding. So they're not the greatest thing. If you can pony up a little bit more money and have somebody do it professionally, that's a better way because they can yank all the water that gets injected into your
You know, when you talk about what you're saving in money is not the time that you have to put it. You have to go pick it up. You got to mix all the chemicals. You got to do it yourself. Right. And then you take this thing back. It's in the end, you're saving like 30, 40, 50 bucks.
Who needs that? Mac, please ask Gunner if he saw the Andy McCabe interview and does he have any thoughts?
That would be news.
And you stayed away from that? Oh, my God, Mike. You need to watch it. He did a Andy McCabe, formerly FBI, got fired like the week before his pension kicked in or whatever. He got fired. And he went on CBS to talk about why he initiated the investigation of the president and what he thought. And you're listening to it thinking, don't you understand that as a law enforcement official in this country, you work for somebody else? And that person is either the director of the FBI or the attorney general of the United States. And that you initiating investigations on your own is probably... You're watching
it's
it and I...
It's
like,
problematic, yeah.
Oh, I was like, are you kidding me? So, and I hate the discussion when that skews towards Sean Hannity being right about anything and the whole discussion of the deep state. But you're watching it with those FBI clowns, watching it in motion, man. So, anyway, so, well, good thing. No wonder you're happy. You haven't watched any of that, of that crap.
No news, man. It's good news. I will not do that.
Please tell Mike to listen to yesterday's roundtable with Tim Lynch and Jeff Kenney, especially towards the end when you ask what your favorite firearm is, and both of them responded that it's a .45. Please tell the
guys. They're old guys. They don't know any better.
Well, I tried to educate them. I said, look, we wouldn't even have the .45 if we would have had better ammunition architects back then because we would have simply manufactured a better bullet for the .38 revolver, and we would have been good.
What'd they say to that?
You don't know. I said, all right, if you want me to haul Musselman on, I will, but he will slap the shit out of you with all this stopping power bullshit.
Oh, let me tell you about the .45, Mac. Oh.
Yeah.
I'm not going to beat up on people.
Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do.
Yeah.
Ignorance.
Too easy to beat up on people like that.
I tried to talk to them, but they were not having it. They were like, no, Mac, you don't understand. It's not us, it's you. I said, no, it's not me. I know when it's me. It ain't me. They're like, oh, yes, it is. So, anyway.
Yeah.
Give us a Granberry update. What's new in Granberry? You have big-time political connections now. So what's going on in Granbury? Anything exciting?
No, Granbury's still Granbury. That's what's so beautiful about it. It's not that special. Just everyday small town living at its best.
There you have it. From Mr. Happy. Here's another email. Mac, I'm not really used to Gunner being this happy, and I'm not sure that I like it. I like it when he's angry and he's spitting fire when he comes on. This happy, docile human being, I'm not sure I'm okay with it.
The universe is screwed up right now.
The universe is out of balance today, so everybody be careful on this Valentine's Day. All right. Any thoughts? Today's 1 year anniversary of the Marjorie Stoneham Douglas shooting in Parkland, Florida. I played the audio of that. The father and Meadow Pollock's father. Meadow was shot 9 times on the second floor of that high school while the security people waited outside. And her father is the one that I think we all remember the most when he talks about her at the White House summit that went on maybe a month afterwards. And he talks about, you know, I go to visit my daughter in the King David Cemetery now. That's where she is. And shot 9 times. And he said, and I'm pissed, you know. And, you know, I went to a PTA meeting, a PTO meeting, whatever they call it these days. I went to a school board meeting. And the school board decided that it was okay, right, not to hire any more security people, and essentially rolling the dice on the lives of kids in their school district, because we all know the only person that's going to stop somebody with a gun is somebody else with a gun. And so when you decide, yeah, we're not going to do that because if we do that, we can't buy this and we can't give our teachers raises and we can't do that, then I hope it works out for you, because eternity's the rest of your life is going to be a really long time if something bad happens, you know. So anyway, got any thoughts on that?
No, because again, it goes back to personal beliefs. You know, it's a political. There's no common sense. You can't have a common sense argument with people like that. They can't see it. There's nothing you can say, nothing you can do that'll ever change their mind. So, and that's sad.
Yeah, I know. Let me tell you, I mean, it's worse than sad because somebody can get killed because of it. And to me, there's only two choices. You can either hire more people or you can train somebody on the premises. Right, and have set up your own POI with your local police department to get them certified to have a weapon, right, at the school. And that if something happens, their job is to come and engage the shooter so that the shooter doesn't shoot more children. That's their job. And when you say no to both those, in my opinion,
actions speak louder than words, right?
Yeah, you've morally failed your responsibility to the parents and ultimately the children of that community. I think that's immoral.
Yeah, and it goes to, you know, what's the most important thing to them? It's definitely not the children.
And to hear them say something like, "Well, I don't believe in guns," or like, "Yeah, I don't either." But when somebody else has one, right, the only way to stop that person from killing innocent people is to have another person that has one. So I'm with you. I don't believe them. I think they're horrible. Okay? I do own a few. But we're not talking about that, what I believe. Look, I think drugs are bad, too. Do you want to hear the other things I think are bad? But they're a real part of this world, and we have to have real responses to that. And so I just don't. Like, so you want to take your political beliefs and you're going to jam it down all of our throats and then have us cross our fingers and say, I hope that nothing bad happens. And as we know, hope's not a course of action.
Yeah, as they say, hope is really not a course of action you want to go into.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, and if you do, then it would be appropriate if it was your kids and your grandkids that paid for it. Because then you could really be held accountable for your decision. But the way it works, is somebody else is going to pay the butcher bill for your stupidity, and you're gonna sit there and go, oh my God, I really wish I feel so bad. I have the date now tattooed on my forearm, and I can't ever get it out of my mind. Yeah, well, you had a chance to prevent it, and you didn't. So maybe that's an appropriate fate for your dumbass.
Yep.
Anyway, what else did I have? I had something else here. On this day in history, the St. Valentine's Day Massacre took place in Chicago as seven rivals of Al Capone's gangs were gunned down. They were apprehended and brought to the garage by people in police uniforms. They were lined up, and they were murdered with Tommy guns, as it were. So that happened on this day in history. Oregon was admitted to the Union as a 33rd state. That happened on this date. Yeah, no, I mean, Oregon, like...
Wow, yeah.
Other than growing dope. On this date in 1912, Arizona became the 48th state in the Union and would remain that way. We would remain at 48 until what? 1950, when Hawaii or Alaska comes in? What's... When either one of those happens. On this date in 1962, First Lady Jacqueline Kennedy conducted a televised tour of the White House. Had never been done before. Jacqueline Kennedy, a rock star in the country, along with her rock star husband.
Right.
On this date in 1989, Iran's Ayatollah Khomeini called on Muslims to kill Salman Rushdie, author of The Satanic Verses, a novel Khomeini considered to be blasphemous. So, and then, and honestly, Rushdie has been in hiding since. And it's amazing that he hasn't been murdered by one of those crazy people. On this date, 1989, Union Carbide agreed to pay $470 million, which now I think is cheap, to the government of India in a court-ordered settlement of the 1984 Bhopal gas leak disaster.
Really?
Yeah.
I remember that, yeah.
That's a half a billion dollars? That's it? Hold on. Let me get a little bit more information. For those of you who don't remember this, this gas plant in India sprung a leak and it killed over 500,000 people were exposed to methyl isoyate. MIC gas. At least 3,787 people died.
How many?
That sound right? The world's worst industrial disaster. The pesticide plant was surrounded by a shanty town, leading to more than 600,000 people being exposed to the deadly gas cloud that night. The gases stayed low on the ground, causing victims' throats and eyes to burn, inducing nausea and many deaths. Estimated the death toll varied from as few as 3,800 to as many as 16,000, but government figures now refer to an estimate of 15,000 killed over the years.
Jeez.
Wow. I didn't think the number was even 3,000. So at the low end is 3,800. At the high end is 15,000 over complications over the years. Toxic material, and 30 years later, many of those who were exposed to the gas have given birth to physically and mentally disabled children. And they pay less than $1 billion for that.
That is pretty crazy.
That is crazy.
Now, is that what they paid out to individuals, or is that the total? So the fines that the government took and what the people saw was just a fraction of that. Lawyers take it. Government takes it.
I do not have a good answer for you right now.
Because that's normally what happens in those class action type lawsuits. Is the lawyers are the ones that make out the most, the law firm.
Hold on. Let me see. As you might expect. Thing looks like a ghost town. I'm looking for the details of the settlement, and there's just picture after picture after picture of these poor people that were wow. Can you imagine that? And you know, India and they're poor people, so let me just type in the word settlement And Union Chemical Dow Bhopal disaster. They had something similar like this happen in Minot, North Dakota, when a train derailed, and the local radio station, the guy was asleep, and they were the emergency broadcasting outlet. And so, and so luckily the wind was blowing in a direction that didn't take the gas over the city. But it, you know, big discussion about hazmat going through the city during the hours of darkness, the automation of radio stations and things like that, so you could not get word out, and then an unsuspecting public asleep in their homes as this stuff comes floating over their house. Civilian and criminal cases were filed in the District Court of Bhopal, India, involving Union Carbide Corporation. In June of 2010, seven former employees, including the former Union Carbide chairman, were convicted in Bhopal of causing the death by negligence and sentenced to 2 years imprisonment and fined $2,000 each. The maximum punishment allowed by Indian law. An eighth former employee was also convicted but died before the judgment was passed. I want to get to earlier leaks, the release, acute effects, glass cow, subsequent legal action, post-settlement activity. Hold on. In March 1996, a proposed settlement figure endorsed by plaintiffs, U.S. attorney, of $350 million that would, according to the company, generate a fund for Bhopal victims between $500 and $600 million over 20 years. In May, litigation was transferred from the United States to Indian courts by U.S. District Court ruling. Following an appeal of this decision, the U.S. Court of Appeals affirmed the transfer, judging in January of 1987 that Union Carbide was a separate entity owned, managed, and operated exclusively by Indian citizens in India. So, quite rightly, the case came to the United States. You want to know why? Because the United States will enforce this kind of shit. The government of India refused an offer from Union Carbide and claimed $3.3 billion in U.S. dollars. The Indian Supreme Court told both sides to come to an agreement and start with a clean slate in 1988. Eventually, in an out-of-court settlement reached in February of 1989, Union Carbide agreed to pay $470 million for damages caused by the Bhopal disaster. The amount was immediately paid. Through 1990, the Indian Supreme Court heard appeals against the settlement. In October of 91, the Supreme Court upheld the original $470 million, dismissing any other outstanding petitions that challenged the original decision. The court ordered the Indian government to purchase, out of the settlement fund, a group of medical insurance policy to cover 100,000 persons who may later develop symptoms and cover any shortfall in settlement funds. It also requested Union Carbide and its subsidiary, Union Carbide of India, to voluntarily fund a hospital in Bhopal at an estimated $17 million to specifically treat victims of the Bhopal disaster. The company agreed to this. That's still not that much money, though, considering the number of people that were killed. Wow. That leak on this day. Let's see. What else on this day? Dolly the sheep, the first mammal cloned as an adult, was put to death at the age of 6 due to premature aging and disease. Remember that? That happened in what, the UK? Yeah. That happened in the UK. Iran, in 2006, Iran said it had resumed enriching uranium, prompting Russia and France to call on Tehran to halt its work that now Russia supports. On this date in 2008, a former student shot 5 students to death in a lecture hall at Northern Illinois University before committing suicide. And on this date in 2011, the TV game show Jeopardy began airing, the first of 3 episodes pitting human players Brad Rutter and Kevin Jennings against an IBM computer by the name of Watson. You know, I submit that if you watch Jeopardy growing up, and through high school, that you could get through college mostly on the knowledge you've gleaned by watching Jeopardy.
Huh.
Did you ever watch the show?
No.
Well, then you can't comment on it.
No, I game shows. I'm trying to think. Like, I'm not a big fan of them. I mean, Jeopardy is probably one of those. You know, it takes some brain power to actually use.
Thank you.
But I'm trying to think of another one that would be the same tie.
There wasn't. The rest of them were all like monkey shows.
Right.
Jump up and down, scream and yell.
Yeah.
Solve
Family
a puzzle.
Family Feud, no.
Yeah, it's more, Jeopardy is like smart person game show. My mom used to watch, the reason I watched it was because my mom watched it. And so there was only one TV, and, you know, if you were hanging around the house in the summer, you know, Kathleen was watching Jeopardy with Don Pardo. That's right, smoking her parliaments. And that's the way it worked. So, but then, you know, I'm not without a brain, so I would like history, you know, my certain categories. Science was not one of them. I did not like that one. History, sports, what else was I always good at? That's probably, I don't know, of the categories, that was probably the major ones. World geography, I was okay at.
Yeah, world geography was good.
I was good at that. I'm trying to think of other Jeopardy categories that I was okay at.
All the mathematics stuff was
right.
Fun.
And then that fed right into the game Trivial Pursuits.
Yeah, I used to love that game.
I remember playing Trivial Pursuits in a... as a lieutenant in 29 Palms, because there was nothing else to do, right? And I was kicking everybody's ass, which I was absolutely loving. And then another lieutenant gave Rich McMonagle, I don't know if you know Rich, but you probably do.
Yeah, I knew Rich.
He gave Rich a haircut, and Rich wound up looking like a mushroom, like with the sidewalls really close and then with a big tuft of hair. And he got upset about it, which was really funny to watch, during the middle of the Trivial Pursuits game. And, so very funny stuff. Cable, tell the gunner to hop into his Rambler, take a drive to the beach and see if he can locate where the Atlantic cable enters the ocean. That will wake him up.
I know where it enters the ocean. I've seen pictures of it. There's a documentary on
where the Atlantic cable is.
The place is called, like, Heart's Content or something like that.
What? There's a place where the cables go in?
Yeah, it's a museum now.
No kidding.
Yeah, the actual cables come out of the water and go right to this building.
How many cables run? Is there, like, cable everywhere on the ocean floor?
There is now, yeah. It's everywhere.
Okay. I got one more email from our friend George, okay? Mac, I hope this puts all your questions to rest. Because we kind of called George out the other day because he didn't really get us an answer. He gave us a lot of education about electricity. All right? Please find attached a PDF offered by IEEE magazine that thoroughly explains the topic. Below is the link to the website that I was able to download. The document is attached. When you get to the section Telephone Service TAT TAC 1, it talks about repeater cables developed by AT&T in the 1920s. Most everything used prior to that was use of Morse code. There is included a history of communication charts that shows words per minute via Morse code. Then when telephone began, followed by fiber. All right, so here's the document. What does George do for a living? Is he an electrician?
I think he's an engineer. I can't remember.
So
works in the city.
So you don't know if he's an electrical engineer.
He might be an electrical engineer.
Although the
George is a smart guy. He's fun to talk to because he like, and the reason he likes the show is because it. Smart, yeah, it's like all topics.
Smart guy. This is a show for smart people and sometimes for dumb people. In August 1958, the world witnessed a historic event in the history of telecommunications, the successful transmission of telegraph messages across the Atlantic Ocean. Although, let's see. Although the transatlantic cable carrying these messages failed after a few weeks of operation, And it wasn't until 1866 that a permanent transatlantic cable transmission became possible. The 1858 transmissions were heralded worldwide as a major achievement, introducing a new age of information. It just wasn't very much information.
No, it proved that it could be done.
Exactly. Right. Interestingly, it took almost 100 years until the first transatlantic telephone cable, TAT-1, was successfully launched.
That's pretty crazy. 100 years.
A message from the Queen as a result?
All right. Well, and the first message that took like hours, 4 hours. Yeah.
Oh, my God. Well, this is a lot of information about TAT-1. It's a specific question, right? As flaws were identified and corrected, confidence in ultimate success grew. Money was raised for yet another cable in 1866, which was successful. The cable brought ashore at Heart's Content. Nice.
That's it.
And a message was sent from Vancouver to London on July 31st, 1866. There was a double triumph as the Great Eastern grappled for and found the end of the 1865 cable, thus in a stroke. There was two fully operational cables! There has been continuous operations ever since. Celebratory messages were passed between Queen Victoria and President Andrew Johnson, who took over for Abraham Lincoln after Lincoln was assassinated.
Wow.
The rate of transmission was 6 to 8 words per minute. And there's a table. Subsequent telegraph system. But see, here's the problem. We still don't know if there was boosters in the cable of 1866.
No, you're saying there wasn't. It was used with the galvanometer. So the galvanometer received the weak signal right on the other end. So that's why he said there's still power, you know, pushing it power, and then that transmission got weak, and then it got to the galvanometer on the other side, and then it was amplified through that.
All right, so here's rates.
It wasn't until later on.
So Atlantic Newfoundland, that cable, so from in the Atlantic Ocean from Ireland to Newfoundland, right, it was 6 to 8 words per minute. Mike schooled us about that. Long cables and automatic transmitting equipment in 1898, 40 words per minute. Whoa, that's a revolution right there. And then the Newfoundland cable to the Azores in 1928, 2,500 characters per minute, 400 words per minute. That's 10-time increase in about 20 years. TAT-1 in 1956, 36 telephone cables, and that was when you had to call the overseas operator.
36 lines of communication.
And now, then it just goes, let's see, it goes up.
I wonder what the price was to make a phone call.
And how did they charge?
Operator.
And how did they charge you? Did she write down the time?
Because that was in the day, so you know, way before my time, but you read about it, you watch some of the stuff. When you call the operator, and they would say, okay, and if there was not a line that was accessible at that time, they would call you back. So you'd be on a list, and then when they call you back, then they would say, you know, prepared to make a call, and then they would patch you through, and then you talk, and then you're charged at that point, the use of the line.
Yeah, it was the overseas operator. They'd answer the phone, overseas operator. Like, you dialed 0 for your operator, and then you dial a different, like, you know, 0.
Please connect me to the overseas operator.
Stand by.
And there was some lady with a headset on with switches that would plug in.
And then they'd listen. Oh, my God, they're breaking up again. Shit, I hate when that happens.
Yeah.
So that's how that stuff worked. But listen to the rate. The rate expands. Let's see. Bhopal disaster, today's famous birthdays. Where the hell did that go? I lost it. Oh, well. Oh, well, that's the way it goes.
It expanded pretty quick. It went from like 36 to like 4,000. And then it expanded even more, like to 40,000.
Oh, here we go. Yeah, it went from 36 telephone channels in 1956, right? That's post-World War II. How the hell did we communicate during World War II? carrier pigeon, right? I don't know. In 1961, 5 years later, there was 80. In 1963, there was 138. And we stay at 138 until 1970, when we get 845. 1976, 4,000. And then in 1988, we have 2 fiber optic cables, right? And 9,000 gigawatts. So
yeah, you know. That's when it really goes crazy. But the other ways they communicated was radio waves, you know, bounce them off the atmosphere.
Yeah, come on. That doesn't work. People make stuff up. Like, what did he say? He said no.
What? Yeah, but that was easily intercepted. That's right. Why the Japanese, we were intercepting all their transmissions because we were picking them up through the, you know, the atmosphere.
And then there's a diagram, flexible repeater. So 20 feet tapered a cable, 8 feet repeater housing, right? And then a gain of 60 decibels, top frequency, gas diode, identification crystals, associated passive elements. I don't know what most of any of that means. That's what I'm curious about, though. So my RFI request for information is very specific. So how did they solve the technological problem in that the first cable that they laid, they had to raise the voltage in it, and then the voltage compromised the housing of the cable? That didn't happen in 1866, and that's what I'm curious about.
Yeah.
What did they do to make that? Because this is like monkeys, like, you know, carving on the side of a cave, you know?
Or we're playing with fire.
Yeah, well, for the first time.
How did that happen?
Yeah.
Create that spark again.
Yeah, like Magellan, like, no, you don't understand. Guess, hey, McNamara, huh? It's not flat, it's round. No. The map in the church says it's flat. Yeah, they're wrong. What? Don't say that out loud, Magellan.
It does not fall off a cliff.
No, we're going to go around the world, and guess what? On the other side, there's women that run around naked. What? All right, I'm in. Don't tell my priest, though. That's how that stuff happened, you know? And so I always loved that, those people that, like, looked over the horizon and said, oh, no, not that, this. What? Yeah.
Yeah, there's not serpents waiting to destroy your ship at the end of the horizon.
That
was a breakthrough.
Oh, my God. I mean, you look at the world that they're, you look at the world that they live in. And you see these people that do look over the horizon. Like Martin Luther, another thing, he calls bullshit on the Catholic Church, right? Hammers that thing, right? On the door of the cathedral or deliver it to somebody. It's like, okay, you didn't do that back then, right? That was like messing with the karma of the universe, and we're all going to get in trouble. And you had people that said, yeah, that's bullshit, I'm going. Or can you imagine, I mean, the pilgrims, we're going to get on this rickety boat, and we're going to try to go across the Atlantic to the New World.
Yeah, I have no concept of what that looks like. Like, how long, yeah.
Yeah, what?
Some scientist who figured it out, when he watched ships returning, he'd see the tip-top of the mast first, and then it would slowly rise, and then to the sea of ships. So then he's calculating, like, it has to be round, because that would... If it was flat, then it wouldn't work that way. It has to be round, because we're seeing it.
No, they just didn't get to the flat part yet. It's there. Oh, it's there. See, this is me burning it down as a priest. Oh, no, it's there. You just didn't find it yet. And I don't understand the curve. Okay, that's too complicated.
It'd be cool to, like, if you could time travel, go back into, like, medieval.
And this
with the knowledge that you know right now, and just, like, converse with somebody.
Yeah, let me show you. Let me take you to a place. Like, I have that thought about, like, if you brought Thomas Jefferson and James Madison and you know, John Adams and the guys who wrote the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, that kind of group of guys, and say, come hither. This is what you wrought. This is what you brought together. This is what it is today. And what they would look at and say, what? That? No. We didn't mean that. We didn't mean that. No, you got that wrong. You got that right, though. That's good. Whoa, what is that? That's a Corvette? I'd like to drive that. What do you call driving? Is that driving? Is that what you call it? The guy who sits behind the steering wheel. Yes, that's
called
driving.
That woman is showing skin around her neck.
Yes, it's wonderful, isn't it? Do you want to go to a place, a burlesque place, where they'll show a lot more of that? You have such things? Yes, it's a great country.
I could see her ankles burn her at the stake.
I don't think Jefferson and Madison, those guys would be like that. I think they would be like, wow, that's kind of cool. Does anybody get in trouble? Can we go get arrested? No. Not as long as you keep your hands to yourself. Oh, I'm okay with that. And you can have liquor served to you there. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Shall we go? Shall we go, boys?
Comments would be, how come you guys are putting up with this? Why don't you raise revolt and take this back?
That would be interesting, though, wouldn't it, to be a part of that discussion, I think, is absolutely, I mean, like you say, I'd love to. So who would you like to talk to? And let me just take Jesus of Nazareth, the historical person, off the table. Right, so, because I would want to talk to him. Who would you want to talk to? Time Traveler Musselman. I used to watch that show in the 60s called The Time Traveler. No, The Time Tunnel. I'd love that show. They would go back to historical.
There's a lot of people. I'd go back and I'd talk to, like,
give me one.
Napoleon Bonaparte.
Why? And ask him, why is your hand inside your tunic all the time? Like, come on, man.
Yeah. Or, hey, here's what they're going to do to you in Waterloo.
I just want to listen and then have them look at me like, our time traveler, is that a good idea or a bad idea? I can't say anything because I can't do, Marty McFly told me I can't adjust outcomes, but good luck. You might want to bring your earplugs. What do you say? What do you say?
I mean,
what does that mean?
There'd be a lot of, like, I'd like to be on one of the three ships with Christopher Columbus.
Oh, really? Would you want to be on the Nina, the Pinta, or the Santa Maria? I'd want to be on the Santa Maria.
Santa Maria.
Yeah, that would be the good luck one. You don't need to be on the other ones. Who knows what's going to happen with them. I would like, I already mentioned one. I'd like to talk to Martin Luther. Because he was so, like, for his time, he was so, like, out of step with what he did. And
Martin Luther. Yeah, I mean, there's a ton of them.
Well, name a couple more that you would like to talk to.
I would like to talk to, like, go way back, Alexander the Great.
Really? I have no desire to talk to him.
I do.
Why?
Talk to him. I just like to hang out with him for a day.
Yeah, I want to go ashore on Iwo Jima.
No, not me.
In a bubble. You can't touch.
Okay, a bubble? Yeah, bubble, sure.
Bubble, no. I want to go. Yeah, I'd like to see that. I would like to see that fighting because everything I've read about it, you know, I mean, what a unique battle, Thunderdome, right? 60,000 combatants on an island, 20,000 below ground, 40,000 above ground, and essentially no prisoners taken.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of those.
Cage match.
If you're in the bubble, yes.
Yes, I want to. I'd love to go see. Yeah,
Sir Edmund Hillary.
Oh, you'd have to go see Shackleton.
I would definitely, I'd be hanging out with Shackleton. I'd
you'd
be
want to
with
go
Sir Edmund Hillary.
You'd have to go see Shackleton. You love that guy. I would also, I wish I could have gone to the reunion of the bomber crew and the pilot what's the name of the book, Mike?
A Higher Call.
Yeah.
Charlie Brown and France, Charlie and France.
Is the guy's name Brown? Because that's the same. The name of the guy of the aviator that got shot down, the first black naval aviator at the Chosin, and his friend Hudner crash lands his plane and tries to get him out. Hudner.
Oh, that's Devotion.
Yeah. Devotion, yeah. Hudner, who just recently passed away. Medal of Honor recipient. I've never read that in my life, that somebody crash landed their aircraft to get their friend out. That is one of the most amazing stories I've ever.
I gave that. Right? Well, I lent that book to a buddy of mine who's just had some surgery and he's been laying in. And he's a former FBI guy, and so I told him to. That's his reading assignment. He's got to read that.
No, and it's the way we kind of discovered those books was funny because I was talking about one and Mike says, I read a book and they're both written by the same guy.
Yeah, Adam Marcos.
Marcos. Yeah. But they're incredible stories. I would want to go to that reunion and sit there and listen to the discussions that went on there. I would want to do that. I'm trying to think anything. I've always been fascinated with Pearl Harbor, and I've always been fascinated with the Titanic, and I've always been fascinated with Custer. I want to be like one of Custer's guys, like riding with him, to know like what, like at some point, like didn't you think that like dividing in front of this great force, you know, did you not leave yourself any wiggle room? And
right.
And so I've always
Charlie Brown, yeah,
Charlie Brown,
Second Lieutenant Charlie Brown.
Was he the pilot that day?
He was the pilot of the bomber, yeah.
Wow. I just talked to somebody whose dad, who was it? I just talked to somebody whose dad was a gunner in the B-17. That took no small amount of courage on a daily basis. Here's another email that's funny. You now know that you got the rest of us looking this dumbass stuff up about these transatlantic cables, don't you? I'm curious now about the whole repeater thing. And I haven't found a good link yet, but when I do, I will certainly forward it to you. That's awesome. No, I mean, it's just intellectual being inquisitive. How did it work? And like Mike and I were talking about, you know, tongue and groove wooden pipes covered in asphalt that endured for 100 years in the infrastructure of a city. What is that? How they did it? And all kinds of cool stuff. So anyway, all right. What else?
So the other guy was Jesse Brown, Lieutenant Tom Hunter and Ensign Jesse Brown.
See,
and Tom was the guy that grew up Harvard, Silver Spoon, you know, Country Club, and Jesse was a sharecropper's son from Mississippi, first black carrier pilot in the Navy. And, you know, as they say in the book, you know, defending a nation that wouldn't even serve in a bar.
How about that shit right there? Yep. And then he and Hudner become best friends. And they go on like a med cruise together. It was for their first deployment together. And then they got the squadron got sent to Korea at the Korea Reservoir.
Yeah.
And they were flying in support of operations at the Chosin Reservoir. When
for Marines, yeah.
When Brown,
the Marines on the ground.
When Brown is shot down, and he could not extricate himself from the wreckage, and Hudner...
Right, he was crashed. He crashed, he stuck, and Hudner crash-landed his plane to save his buddy.
Yeah, gets out, and but he could not ultimately get him out of the wreckage, and he died in the wreckage. And then Hudner is rescued by Marines. And so it's... But the story's amazing. The first time you hear it, you're like, what? Both these things. That's what this author, Adam Makos, finds. He finds these incredulous stories of, I mean, things that you just like, I mean, the probability.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, of the picture in A Higher Call that is so cool is it takes place, I think it's taken in Canada or Michigan, and it's of the families and the grandchildren. So it's the implication of this guy's decision not to shoot this bomber down and all these people who walk the face of the earth because of that decision.
Yeah.
And it's this big group of people now with these 17 or however many guys were in the B-17, whatever the crew was, and then all their children and their grandkids. And then you see the German Messerschmitt pilot who finds him somehow before the internet ever gets how he finds his identity and how, you know, and how he tracks him down. I got to read the
And
book.
There's a YouTube video if you want to go watch the reunion of those two. And they meet for the first time in the airport. And, I mean, it's just it's such an amazing story. And you see these two people come back together again and reconnect. It's just... Man, it's all good. I mean, it's an amazing thing. And the other two, I have two other books I haven't read yet from Adam Marcos, and that's Spearhead and then Voices of the Pacific. That Voices of the Pacific I want to read here soon. And that's the Untold Stories of the Marines in World War II. And Spearhead is a tank gunner. And then that whole collision of, you know, in Europe fighting from his perspective. And he does these stories, though, that, like I said, you're reading these things, and you're like, how in the world does he find this stuff?
Right. Yeah, it's needle in the haystack kind of stuff. And he writes these, and the incredibly inspirational and moving.
I'm going to write out to him again because I sent him an email and I never heard anything back because, you know, they're all handled.
Right. They have screeners and people that respond and publicity people. And
right.
So you got to find somebody who knows him that'll say, oh, yeah, no problem. And then when you.
Because they would be like, yeah, I'd love to do this.
They would love to, especially to talk about it in detail. Not like somebody who got the press release about the book and say, so, Adam, what prompted you to write a book like this? You know, that people that would actually have read it and be able to ask detailed questions about it, and very, very, very cool stuff. CNN did a big thing about these guys, too. Anyway. All right, man. Anything exciting going on today?
Just finishing the garage, man.
Dude,
that's
good.
Everything. I mean, everything is off the shelves. Fine. Everything. And I'm
now
going through,
I've got to come to Granberry and inspect.
I'm going through, like, nitinoid detail, like my wood screws. Go in this tray, Phillips standard.
Well, hello, like, what are we going to do, mix them together so we can never find one?
I know. So I'm breaking it all down, man. It's detail.
Are you going to have the jar and you just dump the jar out and go through it? That's not your style. I would not expect to see that.
I already did that today.
Let me know when you're ready for the IG to come to Granberry, and I will make a pilgrimage and inspect the garage.
All right, sounds good.
All right, man. Happy Valentine's Day.
I'll talk to you. Yep.
Happy time. Happy Valentine's Day. One more email before we get out of here. I think you guys have certainly stumbled into a quotient for happiness, and that is changing the lives of the people around you. I just want to congratulate you on the work you're doing. And encourage you to keep it up. The world needs more people that solve problems and get other people to believe in themselves. If we had more people doing that, this world would be a much better place. Congratulations. Keep it up. Semper Fidelis. Yeah, you know, honestly, I think that the experience is I use this word, and I don't use it lightly. I think the experience is transformational. Honestly, I mean, it touches deep in your soul when you help other people. And you know, we're not the kind of guys that talk about that kind of stuff lightly. So, very, very cool stuff. Happy Valentine's Day. If you're just tuning in, today is the 1 year commemoration of the events of Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. So you'll hear Andrew Pollock. He's the father of Meadow Pollock, who was shot 9 times. She was either a sophomore or a junior up on the second deck, as security people did not go up there. And you're going to hear his voice of anguish from not a year ago today, but you're going to hear when about a month afterwards. He was at the White House, and he talked about how pissed he was that there's security everywhere, but there was no security that day for his daughter, and the security that was there did not come to aid his daughter, and he has to live with that every day. It doesn't go away. So keep them in your thoughts and your prayers today. We also talk about espionage in the Air Force, nasty housing in the DOD, and the helpless situation in terms of recourse that military families find themselves in. So, so you'll hear that in the first hour. You'll hear Chris Woodbridge in the second hour. We talk current events with Chris before we talk about the February issue of the Gazette, which is devoted to innovation, and there's a shit ton of it going on in the Marine Corps right now. So you'll hear that in the second hour. We talk about, there's an article bouncing around about a question that Paul Soldra asked. He of Task and Purpose now. He's famous for his starting the Duffel blog. And so Paul was at a kind of a Navy expo in San Diego. They had a panel, and he asked the new head of, I guess it would be the SEAL pipeline, his thoughts on all the different trials. And he said, look, I've commissioned a report that's due to me in 90 days about where we're failing. So we talk about that. I teed that one up for Chris Woodbridge. I also asked him about the housing thing. And then we also talk about something that came up yesterday in the program, which was the intermediate level management in the Marine Corps that has had, that has lived through the Marines United thing, the hazing thing, and are they reluctant to enforce Marine Corps standards on young Marines who desperately need that structure? Because those young Marines will say, he's hazing me. He called me blockhead. He singled me out. He grabbed me by the collar and pulled me out of my rack when I was sleeping in my rack and I was supposed to be at formation. Yeah, that's what he did. What do you mean? Like, you were supposed to be at formation. So he helped you out of the rack? You think we're going to take him to task for that? Just as we would not take you to task if you fought somebody because you were being hazed, we're not going to take somebody else to task because you didn't like the way you got treated when you were UA. Got it?
Got it.
Yeah, so the Marine Corps got a bit of an identity crisis, I think. I need to get the Commandant on and ask him about that stuff. Trust me, I'll make that phone call here pretty quick. Anyway, have a great day. Happy Valentine's Day. Keep the people in Florida in your thoughts and prayers today. And there's a really cool story, actually, that caused my allergies to flare up today. And you'll hear about it in the first hour. And the story is this. A mom and the wife, a Gold Star wife, who kept her husband, who was killed in Fallujah in 2007, a Marine, has kept his truck. They had sons that were a newborn, an infant, and another one that was 4 years old. Well, 12 years later, the 4-year-old is now 16. So she told him in December that she had sold her father's car, his father's car, and he was pissed. She said he didn't talk to me for 2 weeks. What she actually did was she took it in to get it renovated and repaired with the help of a local car dealership and some people who donated the labor and the parts to do this good deed. And then she told her son that they'd use the money to buy a nicer vehicle because it was just too expensive to repair. So she got it repaired, and the pictures are of him at the car dealership. Along with the people that that renovated the Ford Bronco. And so it's a really cool story. I would encourage you to. You know, a lot of times we think that people don't care. And my experience is that when they know, they find out. You can also follow the, there is a link, but it's not a good one, to his father. His name's Nicholas Walsh, and he was a sergeant, and he was killed by a sniper in Fallujah. And so there's cool pictures in there of the
you're listening to all.
There's cool picture of the family and the story behind it is touching too. They fall in love when he leaves the Marine Corps. And they move back to Illinois. He has a job in construction, and he joined the Navy Reserve, right? And she got a job as a nurse. They get married in 2005. After he rejoins the Marine Corps, and she's quoted as saying, "He said, I just have this need. I just feel this is my purpose. It was his calling to be in the military and serve his country." So he goes back. He buys a Bronco in 2006. He wanted a big truck with big tires to haul his gear around. Flew to Colorado to pick up the vehicle and drove it back to Illinois. So anyway, that's the history of it. Nick left for a second deployment in Iraq in April of 2007, about 3 months after their second child was born. Julie had her last conversation with him on the morning of May 26th. He complained of not being able to sleep. He cried and talked about how much he missed his family and wanted to come home. Julie found it odd because he always was the one who was strong and upbeat, insisting that everything was going to be okay. A few hours later, Nick's reconnaissance unit reportedly had to stop on the streets of Fallujah because of a flat tire on a Humvee. When help arrived, Nick got out of the vehicle, which would have been a wrecker or something else, and stood in a circle with about a dozen military personnel. Then came a loud bang. His one friend said he felt the bullet whiz by him, and he heard Nick say, "Oh, that hurts," and then he fell to the ground, and everybody ran to take cover. A sniper's bullet had hit two of Nick's arteries and punctured his lungs. He was 26 years old when he died. So, again, that's a background story of that. Anyway, on this Valentine's Day, you can check that story out. It's in Marine Corps Times. It's a cool story. It's actually written by a local newspaper that covered the event, and Marine Corps Times picked it up. So well done to them. Anyway, have a great day. This program continues right now, so whatever you do, don't touch that dial. And we will see you tomorrow on a Friday edition of All Marine Radio, right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network. So on this Thursday, we are over and out.